telling Putin to back off. Today, Wednesday, September 3rd, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama tells Estonians that NATO will be there for them because the treaty demands it.
We have a solemn duty to each other. Article 5 is crystal clear. An attack on one is an attack on all.
It was a message aimed at Russia's Vladimir Putin as well. Also today, how goods flow in and out of Gaza, even in wartime.
Even there is no trust between us, we have to cooperate in this mission. We work together, but we're working alone.
Plus, how a California rancher hopes to provide a haven for a torture survivor she read about online.
We have orchard trees, we have cattle, and we train horses. We're very remote, but we have a good life. I can offer him gainful employment and a place to stay.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. How tight are the ties that bind us? Russia is certainly testing the ties that hold NATO together. Today, President Obama was in Estonia, where he reassured the leaders of the three former Soviet republics in the Baltics, all NATO members now, with this message.
And I say to the people of Estonia and the people of the Baltics, today we are bound by our treaty alliance. We have a solemn duty to each other. Article 5 is crystal clear. An attack on one is an attack on all.
Tough words aimed at deterring Russia from throwing its weight around in the Baltics. Should President Vladimir Putin be tempted to do there what he's been doing in Ukraine? His support, military and otherwise, of pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine has much of the region feeling anxious. Today, though, Putin was at the center of what could be a turning point in the conflict. I asked reporter Charles Maines in Moscow to give us a recap.
Well, the big news this morning was that, first of all, it came from Kiev, in fact, which is that President Poroshenko had announced that he and Putin had come to some kind of arrangement for a permanent ceasefire. But then the Kremlin, in fact, came out and corrected that and said that Poroshenko jumped the gun. It made him look, I think, rather foolish to a lot of Russians, which is, I think, their preferred way of looking at him. And since then, Putin came out later in the day with an actual 7-point peace plan, which he apparently hashed out on a flight to Mongolia, which I guess is how most of these things are done now. And, you know, it was one of those kind of casual Putin, I'm the only adult in the room kind of events where he once again called for both sides to halt all offensive operations, called for an end to the bloodletting. But I think basically you can look at this as a Russian plan to solidify recent gains in the battlefield in East Ukraine by the rebels.
So will this be accepted, this new ceasefire proposal?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, as far as the Russians say they have the support of President Poroshenko, although the Ukrainian side has been quite quiet ever since they made this kind of gaffe with the original announcement of a ceasefire. But I think fundamentally, if you go back to what's happening here, you've seen the rebels make some significant gains on the ground backed by Russian artillery. So I think that the threat of standing over Kiev right now is that we'll continue this pressure on the Ukrainian forces if you don't accept this plan.
Were Russian eyes and ears also kind of trained on Estonia today because President Obama was there? Estonia is a NATO member but also has a sizable Russian-speaking population, and we heard what Obama said earlier. But what was the reaction from Putin?
Well, I think there were a lot of Russian eyes on this. Putin was on this plane ride to Mongolia, so I don't know if he was exactly commenting on this per se. But you've certainly seen announcements by the Russian sort of military that they're planning strategic nuclear arsenal, will conduct a major exercise later this month. They're looking at revisiting their military doctrine, which has been in place over the past several years. And I think there's just this general sense, you know, kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy here where all along, you've had hardline forces within Russia that have always argued that NATO is the real enemy, and now NATO's sort of transitioning to this new, or paying more attention certainly to Russia and looking at the interest of some of these Eastern European allies in NATO. I think there's a lot of people in Russia who would argue that all along we've been the enemy. And Putin basically subscribes to that point of view.
You've told us in the past, Charles, that Vladimir Putin seems to treat military actions like a judo match. He's well known in that sport, kind of falling back in order to strike the opponent. Do you see this playing out again?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, I guess I look at this peace plan and it just seems more like, what would be the metaphor? It's almost as though, you know, you have a firefighter who's an arsonist, you know, a secret arsonist. And, you know, here he comes in and he's lit the fire and then he's coming in to save everyone. And not only that, he's going to collect on the insurance. But fundamentally, the thing is the Russians have basically already gotten what they want. You know, if they've created this corridor for the separatists in East Ukraine, if they seem to have held on to these gains that they have, then it makes sort of Ukraine fundamentally an unstable state, and it makes it fundamentally unable to join NATO, which is, you know, one of the things that's being discussed this week.
Charles Maines in Moscow, always great to speak with you. Thanks for making it plain.
Thank you, Marco.
Ukraine and Estonia aren't the only places where leaders are worried about possible Russian expansion. President Vladimir Putin's also ramping up the rhetoric aimed at another former Soviet state, Kazakhstan, in Central Asia. Last week, Putin questioned whether Kazakhstan really is a nation. He called the country part of the large Russian world. The World's language editor Patrick Cox joins me now to explain what that means in terms of language. What was Putin suggesting, Patrick, with that notion that Kazakhstan may not be a nation?
Well, he was suggesting that Kazakhstan is essentially a nation dreamed up by just one man, Nursultan Nazarbayev. He's Kazakhstan's president. He has been since Kazakhstan became independent from the Soviet Union. And Putin said that Nazarbayev had, quote, done a unique thing. He created a state in a territory that had never been a state before. The Kazakhs had no statehood. That's what Putin said. And not surprisingly, it's left them wondering whether they're next, whether Russia has any plans to move in on them.
I.e., if you're not really a nation, then you can come back to us, Russia.
Right.
So Kazakhstan, we know, is oil and gas rich, and it's attractive to outside investors. Did the Kazakhs do anything to provoke the Kremlin?
Well, they've been asserting their independence recently from the Russian sphere of influence. And this is where the language bit comes in. The Kazakh government wants to switch the writing system of the Kazakh language. Currently, they use the Cyrillic script, just like the Russian language does. But they're looking to switch to the Latin alphabet, the one that English uses. And for assistance, they've turned to a linguist, a phonetics specialist. His name is Allard Jongman. He's a Dutchman who teaches at the University of Kansas. Here he is talking about how he first got involved in the project.
I was contacted by a graduate student, and he wrote to me rather than the professor because he knew English and the professor doesn't know any English. And he kind of explained the situation, said, look, we're trying to convert our writing system, but step one is trying to figure out what the consonants and vowels of the language are. We actually don't know exactly what the consonants and vowels of Kazakh are.
Wow, really? Why would that be, Patrick? I mean, why wouldn't Kazakh speakers know what their own language sounds like?
It's because they've been using the Cyrillic script for decades, had it imposed on them as they see it when they were part of the Soviet Union. And because Cyrillic is so associated with the Russian language, it may not represent Kazakh sounds as well as it represents Russian sounds. And so over the decades, those utterances in Kazakh may have actually slipped in how they sound.
So Russian-Kazakh identity, not only in terms of geography, but also in terms of just what comes out of people's mouths now.
Absolutely. And the hope is that the Latin script will more accurately represent how Kazakh sounds, or at least how it sounded before it took on the Cyrillic script. Of course, it may not do. It may just make the language sound a little bit more like English. And Jongman, the Dutch linguist, is fully aware that things could backfire.
It's a much greater responsibility that somebody who does phonetic research typically has. It also means they really screw things up. So I marvel at it, but I wait until, you know, we're done with the project, and I hope that the outcome will be a good one.
Oh, could go either way. How soon is this alphabet change going to happen in Kazakhstan?
Well, the plan is for it to be put into place over the next 10 years. But the government did back away from a previous plan. And with Russia looking on, who knows? If they do go ahead, though, it certainly wouldn't be the first time that language policy has led to something a little bit more serious.
Hooked on Phonics, take note. Whole new nation about to take on the language. The World's language editor, Patrick Cox, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Thanks to the Central Standard Show on station KCUR in Kansas City for that tape of linguist Allard Jongman. You can hear the full interview with Jongman at PRI.org. Now to Moldova, another former Soviet republic that's feeling the heat from Russia. Moldova is Europe's poorest country, and its leaders are hoping that closer ties with the European Union will help the local economy. Another point, Moldova also produces good wine, which is popular throughout the former Soviet Union. And Russia, which is upset by those closer ties with Western Europe, has responded with a series of embargoes on Moldovan agricultural products, including wine. Some of the best Moldovan wines come from a remote part of the country known as Gagauzia. Reporter Jacob Resnick went there to find out what impact the embargo is having.
We're at Gagauzia's famed Kursovo winery. White wine boils in beakers as a technician checks the alcohol content. Elena Seri says she's trying hard to modernize to bring the winery up to European standards so she can sell her wine there. But she says Russia's embargo has hit hard.
In September, when the agriculture embargo hit, it was already the middle of the season. The wine was already made. And for us, the ban on the Russian market is really a big blow, because nobody buys as much as the Russians.
But the wine embargo isn't just upsetting financially. The economy of Gagauzia, like much of Moldova, is dependent upon exports. And when exports stop, jobs dry up, and people leave.
I'm very worried, not as a business owner, but as someone from Gagauzia, that a very big number of people are leaving.
Russia says it's concerned about hygiene at Moldovan farms and wineries. But last year's agricultural embargo curiously came just as the Moldovan government signaled that it would sign a trade pact with the European Union. Moscow has said often and loudly it perceives that as a threat to its sphere of influence. Russia recently exempted five of the largest Gagauzian wineries from the ban, which may appear to be an act of goodwill, but it's also creating or exacerbating a wedge between Gagauzia and the rest of Moldova. Back in February, a few months after the Russian embargo kicked in, Gagauzia held a referendum on the region's future. Nearly all voters chose closer ties with Russia, not Europe. The Gagauzian region's deputy governor, Valery Yaniolo, complains that officials here weren't consulted on Moldova's decision to sign on with the EU.
One direction is pro-Western, the other is pro-Eastern. And if you choose one of these, it means it will create tensions, and Moldova doesn't need this. So that's why we think the signing of the EU association agreement was premature.
He says if Moldova continues to threaten Gagauzia's autonomy, his assembly would declare independence, even though, as he acknowledges, it would most certainly increase tensions. If this all sounds eerily familiar, it's because it is. As with Ukraine, there are distinct regions in Moldova. The Gagauzian area is overwhelmingly Russian-speaking, the Orthodox Church is a major part of the people's cultural identity, and many people here look to Russia or Turkey for jobs, not Europe. But would Gagauzia really secede from Moldova? The civil war gripping Ukraine would seem a poor example to follow, but like the Eastern-Western divide in Ukraine,
we do have lots of issues and problems with respect to the Gagauz autonomy that need to be addressed. There's no denying it.
That's Vladislav Kolminsky, a political advisor to Moldova's prime minister in the capital, Chisinau. He says with its wine embargo, Russia is purposely stirring up those long-standing grievances and once again risks creating trouble in a former Soviet republic.
This clearly has to do with some grand geopolitical designs, but we see the fact that it is drawing closer to the European Union and the primary development program that will enable us to become an independent state. And so therefore, you know, we will likely show and demonstrate to the Russian Federation that it is not aimed against their interests in the region, and hopefully relations will get back on track.
In the meantime, though, the wine embargo threatens to crush producers still locked out of the Russian market, and perhaps even those who can sell their products there. The Kursovo winery was one of the five Russia exempted from its embargo after agricultural inspectors had a look. But winery owner Elena Sari says she's worried it may be too little too late for the region's economy.
It's really disturbing that so many people are leaving, so many young people. In our region, we love our nature and our climate and our homeland very much. This is our home and the home of our ancestors.
As the next harvest nears, the question is whether Moldova's wine industry, its most valuable export, will be its economic salvation, or whether it'll be used as leverage by Russia to further divide Moldova and frustrate its efforts to look westward. For the world, I'm Jacob Resnick in the autonomous region of Gagauzia, Moldova.
Still ahead, import-export in Gaza, where the importers never meet the exporters. On The World from PRI. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. I've never had surgery, knock on wood. Let's face it, though, the idea of being unconscious and going under the knife is scary for everyone. Would you feel better, though, if your surgeon's every move were recorded? That's what a doctor in Canada wants, operating rooms equipped with something like those black boxes on planes. They'd record both audio and video of a surgery. Then the surgical team would review the tapes the same way sports teams do. Teodor Gruncharov is a surgeon behind the project. He's a minimally invasive surgeon at St. Michael's Hospital and professor at the University of Toronto. Dr. Gruncharov, why do you think surgeries should be recorded?
Well, surgery is a high-risk, high-performance industry. Whenever we perform something at such a high level, there is obviously a lot of pressure to be as safe as possible. We know what the black box did for the aviation industry. It helped investigators analyze performance, analyze the chain of events that led to adverse outcomes, and helps prevent them in the future. So we wanted to adopt this approach in surgery.
Right. So you could also use it to test students, I gather, for aptitude as surgeons?
We can not only test them, but use the findings during these tests to provide them constructive and objective feedback and help them overcome their learning curves much faster.
Do you think this could actually maybe weed out people who should not be surgeons?
Yeah, this is one of the initiatives our team is currently working on. We're trying to develop a curricula that will allow us to identify people with exceptional abilities very early in their training and give them this feedback. And those who have exceptional abilities would love to obviously recruit them to a surgical career. And those whose technical abilities are not to the level we expect them to, provide them feedback and direct them to other areas where they can use their talents.
With this black box scenario, you're going to be recording audio, recording video. That's a lot of data. Are there any privacy issues that you're concerned about here?
Absolutely. We are very much concerned about the privacy of our patients and also the privacy of the people in the room. Everybody who is in the room needs to consent, including the patients and the surgical teams. And also, as soon as we analyze the data, we de-identify it and anonymize it, and we prevent it from being used for other initiatives that are not intended within our current project.
Well, one thing that strikes me is malpractice. Will this become a tool for lawyers?
I think it's important to underline that at this point, this is a tool to improve performance, improve safety, and reduce costs. We hope that this concept is used for constructive rather than destructive purposes.
Right, but isn't part of quality control, honestly, punishing those who really screw up and make someone's life miserable after surgery? I mean, and now you have evidence to prove it.
We have to think of what benefits not one single patient, but what benefits the society and patient safety in general. And I think at this point, we want our surgeons and surgical teams to feel comfortable using this technology. We want them to be open and transparent about their performance. And I think any initiative that brings improvement of quality should be protected.
You've had surgeries that you've been involved in recorded like this. So how's it affected your own performance, doctor?
It showed me that even though I've been practicing for more than a decade and I felt that I had overcome the learning curve and I was perfect, it showed me that there are many areas or many details that could be done better. So I feel that this technology helped me identify my own weaknesses. It helped me figure out ways how to deal with these weaknesses and ultimately made me a better surgeon and a better teacher.
So how do you think this is actually going to change the numbers of people who either die on the operating table or have really bad outcomes?
It will help us understand and accept that we're not, and our patients to accept that their surgeons are not perfect, that their surgeons may make a mistake. What's not acceptable is not to learn from these mistakes and not to develop a system that prevents mistakes from happening again and again.
Dr. Teodor Gruncharov, thanks very much for speaking with us. Good luck with the project.
Thank you.
For more about how these new OR black boxes work, we've posted a video explainer. You can watch that at PRI.org. Tennis is believed to have been invented in France, so maybe that's why Gaël Monfils is so comfortable, maybe too comfortable, some say, playing the game. Monfils is one of the most colorful characters in a while to have graced the courts at the U.S. Open in Flushing, New York. He's 28 years old, he electrifies the crowds, and not just with his game. Tennis writer Ricky Diamond has been following him with a lot of interest. Why is there so much love in New York for Gaël Monfils, Ricky?
Well, a lot of people say that he's more interested in being an entertainer than he is in being a tennis player, which is fairly accurate. He sometimes goes out there, you know, dancing during changeovers, sometimes even in between points. He's been more interested in putting on a show than he has in winning tournaments or even Grand Slams, which he certainly has the potential to do. And in some ways, that makes him a frustrating player to watch because we know he could be so good. But at the same time, it makes him to be an amazing player to watch because he's so entertaining. So it's kind of a Jekyll and Hyde situation.
And speaking of music, Malfis is a big fan of American pop music, of Beyonce, I gather. And he's right in Beyonce's backyard.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, he was listening to Beyonce when he walked out into Arthur Ashe Stadium, which is obviously the biggest show court in the United States and actually the entire tennis world. And in his interview yesterday, he told the fans that he was walking out to the court, listening to Beyonce, because that's what was inspiring him at the moment. And the crowd obviously ate that up. They enjoyed it.
How did he get his nickname Slider Man? Is that from dancing to Beyonce?
It's the way he throws himself around the court. If you've ever seen Malfis, you know that he has a tendency to, he has a tendency to get injured, unfortunately. That's a direct correlation of his playing style. You know, that's just what's going to happen because he throws himself around the tennis court all the time. But yeah, you often find Malfis on the ground. It's easier to slide on clay, but he slides on a hard court. He slides on grass. He just throws his body all over the place. Another reason why he's so fun to watch.
Yeah, Slider Man, a good name then. Now, Malfis, in terms of race, his parents are black from the Caribbean, Guadeloupe and Martinique. So in that sense, he kind of fills that handsome Yannick Noah kind of space. For many French, anyway, that was a positive sign that in this mostly white sport, they had a person of color on center court. Does Malfis also have that kind of attraction, both for the French and his American fans?
I think so, yes. An interesting story I have about being such a fan favorite is that last year at the U.S. Open, Malfis was actually playing America's best player, John Isner, and Malfis won over the crowd on his side, even though he's from France, and Isner is obviously America's best hope. So it's kind of interesting to see that people all over the world love Malfis.
He's made it to the quarterfinals. He'll be up against the emotionless robotic Swiss machine known as Roger Federer. What a study in contrast, I got to say. It sounds like Malfis is unflappable with his whatever attitude. Can he make Federer flappable, though?
He can. He certainly has the talent. They played each other in Cincinnati 2 weeks ago, also on a fast hard court, a very similar surface. And he took a set off Federer, but Federer won in three sets. And two of Malfis's previous best Grand Slam events prior to this one also ended at the hands of Federer. Malfis definitely has the game. I mean, he has a huge forehand, huge serve. He's just going to have to maintain his focus and not turn into the entertainer, but remain the Gael Malfis, the tennis player who's not dropped a single set yet this week.
Tennis writer Ricky Diamond in Flushing, New York for the U.S. Open. Thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot.
This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, the strange tale of an undercover cop in London and the wife and son he deserted when his secret operation was over.
The Met has denied that its officers were instructed to seduce civilians as sort of tradecraft, but I think that one could wonder whether the department didn't at the very least turn a blind eye.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Now, there is no doubt. U.S. officials say the video posted yesterday by militants showing the beheading of American journalist Stephen Sotloff is authentic. Today in Estonia, President Obama said the killing will not intimidate Americans. And here at home, Vice President Joe Biden vowed to track down the killers in a fiery speech in New Hampshire.
They should know we will follow them to the gates of hell until they are brought to justice. Because hell is where they will reside. Hell is where they will reside.
The militants who held and murdered Sotloff and fellow journalist James Foley before him call themselves the Islamic State, or ISIS, and one of their strongholds is a part of northeastern Syria, not far from the border with Turkey. The BBC's Ian Pannell is just back from visiting the Turkish side of that border. I asked him to describe what he saw there.
You stand on one side, on the very tip of NATO's southern flank, and 100 yards across the barbed wire fence is the Islamic State and this giant black flag with the Shahada on it, the Declaration of Faith written on it. It flies on the other side of the border. This is a town, Tal Abyad, in northern Syria, that is controlled by the Islamic State in Raqqa province, where there's certainly been some speculation that some of the hostages taken by the militant Islamists are being held.
And for years, you and many other journalists crossed over this border, time and again, undetected by security. I mean, that border was essentially wide open?
Yes, the borders were wide open. We went across. Other journalists went across. Aid workers went across. And so did foreign fighters. The place I'm talking to you from at the moment is a hotel, one of the many hotels that has been frequented by all these people, but you always used to see this mingle of fighters coming in from across Syria, foreigners appearing at the airport. You almost used to joke that some of the planes landing in the local airport was like jihadi airways. You saw these young men coming in from the Gulf, from elsewhere in the Muslim world, but also from Europe, and we believe also from North America, to come and join the fight. Many of them came originally long before ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State existed. Many of them came because they were adamant that they should support what they saw as a justified struggle against President Assad. The argument that you hear, which I find fascinating from people locally and from those who've been involved in the struggle in Syria, is that because the West did not intervene, because no help came, they welcomed the jihadis with open arms. They believed that the jihadis would come and help them in the fight against President Assad. But as we know, that isn't ultimately what happened. They ended up turning their guns on each other.
Ian, you also spoke with a man who trained a suicide bomber who crossed the border from Turkey into Syria. And this person was a U.S. citizen who grew up in Florida. What did this man tell you?
Yes, that's right. He said he'd met this young man from Florida working in one of the refugee camps inside Syria, and internally displaced people, and that he'd been working with children. He was very moved by what he saw, in particular the orphans, and he'd met this trainer who was there with a weapon and said, how could I learn to fight? I want to fight against the forces who he saw as responsible for that. In other words, the forces loyal to President Assad. And so he went to this training camp along with hundreds of others, many of them foreigners. He learned basic fighting techniques. He, like many others, became more and more radical. He ended up joining Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda's official franchise inside Syria. And in May of this year, killed himself and presumably many others in a suicide bomb attack in Idlib province. So, you know, if his story is to be believed, the one of the trainer, is that here you had a young man who was motivated by wanting to help the Syrian people. He was a troubled young man, but he didn't come here as a fighter, according to the trainer. But he ended up becoming one, ended up becoming radicalized, and ended up killing himself and others. And the argument you hear from people inside is this is a story that's repeated many times over.
So from your perch there in Antakya in Turkey, what do you see happening on Turkey's border with Syria now? Are Turkish officials seriously clamping down on these border crossings?
I do see a concerted effort to try and stop people. But when you hear politicians talking about how to deter people from coming out to Syria, how to stop people from joining ISIS or the Islamic State, it feels a little bit like trying to close the stable door after the horse has bolted. I suspect that most people who want to join those groups have already done so and are already across. The challenge is how do you deal with the Islamic State that flies its flag on NATO's border, and how do you deal with the foreign jihadis who threaten to bring the fight home?
Ian Pannell with our partners at the BBC, speaking with us from Antakya in Turkey. Ian, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Last week's ceasefire between Israel and Hamas committed both sides to begin negotiations within a month. But after 50 days of warfare in Gaza, Israelis and Palestinians there are already working together on some things, like the daily transfer of goods from Israel to Gaza. Now, there's only one spot where goods from the outside world get into Gaza, and a visit there is like a trip to the Twilight Zone. Daniel Estrin has that story.
Everything that goes into Gaza, from food to furniture to jacuzzis, passes the watchful eyes of an Israeli man with a ponytail.
You can see here an example of toys that are going to Gaza.
Ami Shaked runs the Kerem Shalom crossing, the only point along the border where supplies get into Gaza. Every day except one during the recent war, Shaked and his staff were working, transferring in basic necessities, whatever the UN or others donated. But only the basics, he says, to minimize the risk they were under while rockets were flying above.
I think that I have to take a risk to supply them food and medical aid and fuel and cooking gas. But I don't have to sacrifice my people to supply them Coca-Cola or some special chocolate for the people of Hamas.
So Gaza got no Coca-Cola during the war. Israel has been enforcing these kinds of strict rules for 7 years, ever since Hamas took over Gaza by force and Israel and Egypt began blockading Gaza. Few Palestinians get permits to travel outside Gaza. There are almost no exports, and imports move only through this crossing. Some call Gaza an open-air prison. I asked Shaked if he plays the role of the jailer.
I'm not a jailer, but as one that wants to live, I will not supply my enemy equipment for his industry to introduce rockets to shot to my people and my family.
So whatever is brought to his crossing, goods ordered by Gaza businesses, international aid, it's strictly inspected to make sure there's nothing there that Hamas can use for military purposes. Inspectors call Shaked over to look at a vat of tomato paste that they say looks unusual. He says it's just tomato paste. The whole method of transferring goods to Gaza is bizarre. The border crossing is made up of 9 open-air parking lots surrounded by high concrete walls. Each lot has a name, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, and each lot has 2 sliding gates on opposite ends. Israeli truck drivers come through one gate, unload goods onto the pavement, and leave. Then Shaked and his security officers inspect the goods. Then a security officer tells all the Israelis to leave the lot. The gate slowly slides shut, complete with its own horror movie screech. And then a gate on the opposite side opens. Gaza truck drivers come in, load the goods, and drive them into Gaza. There's no human contact between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Shaked is the only one allowed in both Israeli and Palestinian sides of the crossing.
Even there is no trust between us, we have to cooperate in this mission, and this is the main idea. We work together, but we're working alone.
Working together, but working alone, that pretty much sums up the relationship between Israel and Gaza. When Israel and Hamas agreed to a ceasefire, Israel said it would start allowing materials into Gaza to help repair destroyed buildings. Israel wants special monitoring for cement and other things that can be put to military use. So for now, it's just wood and aluminum and minor building materials that Israel is allowing. And for the first time since the war, Gaza importers are permitted to import other stuff.
What is this?
Let's see. Sport equipment.
Seated chest press, butterfly, shoulder press, delts machine.
So, like you see, it's almost return to normal life.
As normal as things can be just a week after war, in the twilight zone that is the Israel-Gaza border. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin.
Rice, diapers, toy helicopters, and candy, just some of the items shipped into Gaza from Israel. See what else passes through the heavily fortified crossing some call the Twilight Zone. We've got a slideshow at PRI.org. Our next story takes us south of Gaza to Egypt's Sinai Peninsula and the harrowing story of a man held hostage in Sinai whose saga could very well conclude on a ranch in California. Now, Sinai is mostly desert, a no-man's land of sorts, where criminal gangs run loose. Some of those gangs kidnap refugees from East Africa, Eritrea especially, and hold them in Sinai for ransom. They phone the hostages' families to demand money. And 2 years ago, one family shared the number they were getting calls from with our BBC colleague Mike Thompson. He called back and amazingly managed to speak with the Eritrean hostage. Speaking on a cell phone, Philemon Semare told Thompson that his kidnappers were demanding $25,000, a sum his family did not have.
My family is very, very poor family. There is no money, there is no anyone to help.
What will happen to you if there is no money?
If not money, they will be dead to me.
They will kill you.
Always cut your hands, cut your foot, cut your fingers.
Semari also described how he was tortured by his captors, daily beatings, and what he called burning by fire.
Daily burning by fire and heat by stick. My body is burning, all of burning.
After 7 months of this daily torture and constant death threats, Philemon Semari was finally freed. His family somehow came up with part of the ransom, and after his release, Semari made it to Cairo. He's now waiting for the United Nations to process his application for resettlement. That's where Alicia Taff comes in. She owns that ranch outside Santa Maria, California, and she heard about Semari on the BBC, so she's offered him a job and a place to stay on a ranch. Alicia Taff, why did you try and help Philemon Semari? How'd you even hear about him?
Well, I was online reading the news. I typically check in with the BBC every morning to see what's happening in the world, and came across the article that Mike Thomason had written, and I was pretty horrified, and it just compelled me to reach out to Mike and see if there was anything that Philemon needed or could use. And in touching bases with Philemon by email, it was interesting. He wasn't interested in money. I did see if, you know, he needed something to help him get by to meet his immediate needs. But what it really sounded like is that he needed hope more than anything.
Hope, and it sounds like you're offering him a job and a place to stay as well. Have you spoken with him, and does he know about this offer?
I have not spoken to Philemon, but we have corresponded via emails, and I explained to him that if it were possible, we do have a ranch here east of Santa Maria. We have orchard trees, we have cattle, and we train horses. I told him we're very remote, but we have a good life. I can offer him gainful employment and a place to stay. I have spoken with friends of ours and acquaintances, and they've indicated that they would be willing to help us get him to English classes at the local community college. And I understand that he is a deeply religious person, and I have a friend that would be willing to get him to church at least once a week from our remote location. So it just seems like it would be a potentially a positive thing. I was in touch with Congresswoman Lois Capp's office, and they were fantastic in writing a letter to the UNHCR in trying to gain some momentum for Philemon's case.
And it sounds like the UN may try and fast-track his application, so that sounds somewhat hopeful.
I did just receive that email, and I do hope that that happens for him. I think that people here in the United States, you become numb to all of the things that are going on in the world. Just reading his story and many other stories like his, you know, if every person stepped out and made a time investment in someone else that really needed help, really needed a hand, you know, this would definitely be a different world.
Yeah, I'll say. Have you ever done anything like this before? And why do you think Semari's story affected you so?
That's a very good question, because there are many traumatic, harrowing, tragic stories that come across the line. And just that day, I just felt very compelled to see if I could lend some sort of a hand. It's easy to write a check to a charity or a donation, And it's not so easy in everybody's busy lives to make the time effort. I mean, I certainly couldn't travel to Cairo to try and help out. But this just seemed like if there was a way that I could make a time investment that could make a difference for somebody's future, then if we could all affect such change in someone's life, then the world would be a better place.
Alicia Taff owns a ranch in Southern California. She's offered a job and a place to live for Philemon Semari, an Eritrean man who until recently was held hostage in the Sinai. Alicia, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco. I appreciate the opportunity.
This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. No one likes to be lied to, but if the lies are part of an undercover police operation, at what point does the undercover cop have an obligation to come clean with those he duped? That question is at the heart of a recent story in The New Yorker. It's about a couple, Bob and Jackie. Bob Lambert was a British police officer assigned to secretly infiltrate the animal rights movement. He pretended to be an activist named Bob Robinson. Jackie was an activist who fell for Bob's deception to the point of falling in love with him. Now, decades later, the real nature of their relationship has emerged, and Jackie is one of several women suing British police for deceit and for what she describes as rape by the state. Lauren Collins wrote that New Yorker story. I asked her how Bob and Jackie met in the first place.
They met in 1984 outside an animal rights rally in East London. Jackie was there sort of in her red uniform with a scarf around her neck. She'd just come from working the counter at the Avis car rental. And she doesn't know to this day whether Bob was there expressly to pick her up or whether they met serendipitously and things went from there.
And at the time, what was Bob's mission on behalf of the London Metropolitan Police?
Bob was a member of the Special Demonstration Squad, which is the Met's domestic intelligence gathering arm. So he was beginning an undercover deployment in which his mission was to infiltrate the animal rights scene, which had become sort of increasingly restive across the UK.
So he's undercover. What are the rules for an undercover police officer getting romantic, getting intimate with somebody that they're supposed to be spying on, basically?
That's exactly what everybody's trying to figure out now. We know that Bob was a member of the SDS. The Met has denied that its officers were the police. They've denied that its officers were instructed to seduce civilians as sort of tradecraft during their undercover deployments. But I think that one could wonder, and this is what people, you know, many people have wondered now, after seeing this pattern of women seduced and abandoned according to a very specific template, whether the department didn't at the very least turn a blind eye.
Yeah, Jackie's is an especially sad story, or maybe you're just focusing on her and that's why it's sad. But was she an easy target for Bob, or could it have been any woman? I mean, what kind of woman is Jackie?
This was the question that haunted Jackie herself more than anything, and continues to haunt her in the couple of years since she's learned who Bob really was. She was certainly somebody who was looking for some sort of emotional ballast. She'd had, you know, a somewhat tumultuous upbringing. She'd left home at 16, and she's living by herself and sort of trying to make her way in the world, and I think was in many senses really hungry for affection. So in that sense, she might have been an easy target.
So Jackie and Bob, they're intimate. They're a couple. But at a certain point, he basically walks out on her. Tell us what happened.
Bob and Jackie were a couple. They'd been living together for a while, and they had decided consciously to have a child. Their child wasn't an accident. He was born, and a little bit after that, Bob came to Jackie and he said, "Listen, I've got to tell you something." And he basically said things were getting too hot in London. He'd run into some trouble in the animal rights scene and that he was going to have to leave and go to Spain.
How long is he in Spain for? How long does Jackie believe he is in Spain for before she finds
Jackie him? Jackie never saw him again after he left, after he walked out the door in 1987.
So take us to that moment when Jackie does find out where he is and who he is.
So you have to flash forward 25 years. Jackie is now a high school teacher in the suburbs of London. And the way she told it to me, it's a Thursday afternoon, the start of her weekend. She comes home, goes out to her garden. It's a sunny day with a cup of tea and sits down just to read the day's newspaper. So there she is flipping through the newspaper when a photograph catches her eye. And it's an old picture of Bob, the father of her son, whom she had last seen in 1987. The headline above the picture says that he was an undercover policeman, and that's the first time she had an inkling.
Right. They meet each other after some rather tormented communication. And what does happen to their relationship?
Well, that's the thing. Jackie, you know, as she later put it to me, unlike many of the other women, has a son with this person and presumably may have grandchildren with him one day. And as much as she would like to put this chapter of her past behind her, has to contend with the fact that her son now stands to regain a father, now that Bob Robinson, now Bob Lambert, has sort of come out of the woodwork all of a sudden.
And he's meantime married to somebody else. And so we've got sex, lies, spying by really a handful of British police spies. It's caused a scandal. Jackie and a group of at least 10 other women have sued the Metropolitan Police. What is their case?
So Jackie and other women are suing the Met for deceit, assault, misfeasance in public office, and negligence, which is all a technical way of saying that they feel they were treated inhumanely by the state and that their right to a private life was violated.
There's been a court ruling in the case. Last week, the Crown Prosecution Service said there was insufficient evidence to prosecute four officers for offenses including rape and sexual assault. So have you spoken with Jackie about her reaction? Does this close the matter now?
It doesn't affect the case that she's bringing at all. It simply means that the Met has declined to bring criminal misconduct charges against the officers. I think it's fair to say that the women are probably disappointed. I mean, they'd like to see, you know, the book thrown at these guys, but the ruling doesn't have any effect on the lawsuits that they're bringing, which are under common law and the Human Rights Act.
So what do you think the lesson is from the story of Bob and Jackie? I mean, it's an undercover surveillance operation that went too far. What can we draw from it?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that the players themselves, Bob and Jackie, are still trying to figure out where the psychological aftermath of this leaves them. To me, what was interesting about the story was that it involves a sort of long, strange dance over the course of many, many years between two people who have grown and changed and evolved and maybe regretted and repented in some ways, but are still bound to each other through this thing that happened between them 25 years ago.
In your heart of hearts, do you think that Bob and Jackie were actually in love?
That is the killer question. And I have to say, this is the first story I've ever immersed myself in for months and emerged with more questions than I had when I started it. Whatever the seed of the relationship was and however it germinated, I think if you read through to the end of the story and find out what happens between Jackie and Bob and the triangle that now includes their son, there is some semblance of love there, as complicated and fraught as the relationship remains.
Reporter Lauren Collins writes for The New Yorker. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Wow, what a story. Dipping back exactly 10 years ago to this marvelous reggae and dub version of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, you just don't know truly what's on the other side sometimes, do you? We're on Twitter at PRI The World. I'm there too at Marco Werman. We're back with you here on the radio tomorrow from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, by the Ford Foundation, by PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, MacFound.org. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. And by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.